I have online right now Jim Hughes.
Are you there?
I'm here. Jim wrote a book called Devout Coward and Karmic Vagabond, autobiographical essays and stories. This came into my hands via Eric Toman. I believe that he got it from your son. And I find it to be an absolutely riveting book. How did you decide to write this?
I don't really know, except I guess I just, it had some kind of meaning to me. So, like, all my life, I've done work that I liked, but it was mostly manual. Like, I was a handyman and a general contractor, and I didn't work for anybody. I just I worked for myself, and I enjoyed the work I was doing, but I always thought, you know, I've always got these dreams. I'm always dreaming, you know. My brain is kind of nervous, and I just don't blank out. I think all the time.
Well, your life is, according to this book, has been a real adventure. I mean, you were down in, put in a, for a better word for it, a sanatorium when you were young.
Yes.
And you were a merchant seaman during World War II.
Right.
And you had, what, how many ships torpedoed out from underneath you?
Two.
One is usually an experience that somebody doesn't want to repeat.
Oh, that's right. Well, I was trying to avoid the draft board. And they wanted to draft me into the Army. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to fight a war. So that's how I felt about it. And I just wanted to play the role of a devout coward. I was afraid. You know, I was afraid to kill anybody. I was afraid to get killed. I thought this, you know, war was insane. And I didn't have any great sense of patriotism. It was just... That's what got me to writing, you know, and what, something to that I can remember myself by.
Well, that's really very refreshing, because most people will not admit, to men particularly, that they're afraid.
Oh, that's true.
And, there are times in our lives when we're absolutely terrified, but I think that most men will sort of blow it off and... do a little macho shuffle around it. But to have somebody who says, I was afraid, and I was ready to drop a load in my pants, I think, to me, takes more courage than a lot of men have. So,
I see.
this is one thing I'm always curious about when I talk with writers. What is your writing regimen? Do you sit down and write so many words every day, or so many hours every day, or do you write when the mood strikes you, when the muse is whispering in your ear?
I follow my intuition. I don't program myself, but once in a while I'll say to myself, damn, I've got to get that going now. You know, I'll say it maybe a dozen times before I sit down and get something going.
And,
so I have to talk to myself a little bit.
Yeah. Are you visited by the muse often?
By the news?
The muse. You know, the goddess of, or one of the goddesses of creation, of creativity.
Oh, well, apparently that might be so. They could just sneak up on me. It's kind of like the Daughters of Mara. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Well, it's an a Buddhist thing where you have good intentions, and then the Daughters of Mara will sneak in the side window or the back door, and it's like just blowing away all of your good plans, you know.
Well, I know... Yeah, I know of Mara, but I didn't know Mara had daughters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's I love your final solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict and everything else.
That's not mine.
It's not?
No.
Oh, that's right.
It's written by a friend, Gerald Goodwin, and yeah, that's really great. You know, he's really, really good.
Yeah, if God were perfect, why is this world such a mess? Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, your story of Paul's dilemma, the last two, you know, the short stories in the back, particularly the one about the plover, I found to be absolutely intriguing.
About the what?
The bird that that performs dentistry on the crocodiles.
Oh, right, yeah. Right. So, the plovers.
Did you where did you come up with that? Did you read about that, or
I read about that years ago, and then I was just sitting down one Sunday afternoon, trying to get something written, I thought these crocodile birds. It was kind of I was lampooning what's the word here? It's a lampoon of the hereafter.
Yes.
Like some neighbor had come over. He was one of these Hare Krishna dancers, and he's a nice enough fellow, but he'd come over once in a while and try to influence me to join up, and I... but I just don't believe, you know, anything they say... and take it to be true about how things are in religion, what it's like, what the hereafter is like. It's maybe just a transposition of energy from one form to another, and that there's nothing more about it other than, you know, if we were allowed to bury our carcasses nowadays, we could plant a rose tree over it, you know, and... there's a name for this, that where the process of the energy change. For instance, you're burning a fireplace. You scoop up the ashes, you take it out, stir it into the earth, and then you've got ready-made fertilizer. And you can be reincarnated as a rose or reincarnated as a crocodile bird.
Yeah, there's, I guess, a Joe Hill poem, the great songwriter of the industrial workers of the world, regarding that, that he would come back as a flower, you know, if his ashes were, you know, let to, you know, to be scattered in the wind.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, it's, in a way, it's reincarnation at its basic level. I think the farther down the chain you go, the closer it you get to real, you know, transformation of from one form into another.
Yeah.
There's I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's got to be that way, you know.
There's a beautiful essay by Aldo Leopold called Odyssey. It's about the odyssey of a carbon atom being sucked from a root by a root of a tree from an oak, and then all the different incarnations it takes, the different things that it ends up in.
Oh, that's great!
Very fascinating. So this sort of reminded me of that in a little more literate way.
Okay.
So, do you have anything else in the hopper? Any new books? Any new
stories? I'm putting together, I and my publisher, Paul Ryan, who you can see in the credits of the book, and his daughter, but we're doing an anthology. And so I've written a few stories on that. He's an ex-champion, a boxing champion. He fought at Cal. And so he writes these stories. And then I write my own, you know, strange dreams. His is much more of a left wing sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
Where I'm kind of the opposite extreme, with the exception of the work I like to do. I don't mean to say that I'm maladroit. I'm quite good shape, you know, my balance and all of this. I've been a good balanced person all my life, I guess I put it that way. Some people might argue that point when it comes to the mental, but somehow I feel quite comfortable with myself.
Well, it sounds like you've had a really fascinating life, and it's led you to this point to share it with others.
Yeah.
You know, on the back of your book, and I just want to throw it out there for people to hear, it says, Jim Hughes has had 85 years to reflect on a unique perspective on the adventures of his life. These autobiographical sketches start with a childhood, his parents' gold-seeking misadventures, his time in pre-Praetorium or pre-tubercular boys, after being sunk twice in the Merchant Marines ship trying to avoid World War II draft, a devout coward in parentheses, getting blacklisted by the school district and working with L.A. gang members, he winds up part of a Berkeley fellowship aimed at scientifically exploring LSD. So.
Yes. Those were beautiful days.
Oh.
I thought LSD was one of those, still is, you know, it has the greatest potential of just about any kind of a drug in the world, and it's relatively harmless. Rather, it's not the way the DEA sees it.
No, the DEA sees a lot of things in rather skewed ways, from my opinion.
I know.
And I should remind people that the views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the speakers only, not necessarily those of KBMR's board staff or contributors. Now, if somebody would like to come buy this book, how can they get it?
Well, about the only way I can say is to write to me, and I'll mail it to them.
Okay, you're not on you're not selling on Amazon, or
this is going to come in a couple of months.
Okay. And you want to give some contact information so people can do that?
Oh, sure. I'm interested in marketing it. That's the final step, I guess. I feel quite comfortable with it, and if it's not a great marketable item, that's okay too.
What is it? Thoreau said he had volume. He had a library of 1,400 books, all written by him.
Wow, he's one of my favorite anarchists, you know.
Mine too.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so where? Pardon me?
I was just going to say one thing. The thing that motivated me, I suppose, the most of all to get this book started was that I dreamed, like this is many, many, many years, 60, 65 years later, that I had totally, all of my life, had forgotten this experience at this Praetorium, this private school for sickly boys. But my experiences were so, like, it's in the book. And they were so upsetting to me that I just adopted a separate reality. So I never was me until I'm over 65 years, I'm 70 years old, and I have this dream about the Praetorium and about my bird and being in a glass house. And all of this is where it got started, basically, other than the fact that I always kind of dreamed about writing something.
Okay. Now, you were going to give me some contact information for people who want to buy
your
book?
Sure. My address here, this is area code 661. It's 366-3606.
Okay, and there's a, I guess on the back of your book for the publisher, there is a contact of iUniverse.com. And yes. Can book be found there, too?
It can be found there, and it can be purchased there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim, and good luck. And we'll try and get back to you on your next book. Or if you send me some contact information, we'll get you on the air again.
Okay. And in about 2 months, I expect to be or hope to be up visiting Tim, so perhaps we could meet.
I would love that very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, John.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
One more shorty. Don, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, we're joined on air by Donald the artist, the Trotskyite artist. You have a show coming up. You want to give us some information on it?
Yes, I sure do.
And it sort of fits in because there's a lot of words involved and interaction, right?
Well, yeah. There's reading because I incorporate text in like an assemblage and collage in my art. So it's about black women, honoring black women. It's about history. It's about politics. There's a lot of black feminism, which is an influence to me. So that's that sums up my description, but you have to come and see it.
No.
There's obviously much more to it than that.
When? But, where?
Okay.
And how do you get there?
It's this coming up Saturday, the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Midtown Sacramento, 920 21st Street, from 6 to 10 p.m.
And it's just a one-day?
Well, at where I'm exhibiting, at Body Tribe, because it's weird, it's an art exhibit gym, too. It's this big place. I used to be roommates with the owner. And so the second Saturdays is when it's totally open to the public, because it'll be there for a month, but for the rest of the month, it's people can only come by appointment only.
Okay. Now, what? What is your contact information if people want to get in touch with you?
Like
regarding this, or regarding other of your artwork?
They can just give me a call. I'll give my number.
Okay. And your full name is, because I only know you as
Donald
the Trotskyite.
Donald Bowles, B-O-W-L-E-S. That's okay. My full name. And my phone number is 274-8885. And if people want to contact me, and I'll give them all the information they want.
Now, what is the name of the show?
It's called In Praise of Black Women.
In Praise of Black Women.
At the intersections of sex, gender, race, class, and ideology.
And how did you come to this?
It's gradually been building. It's just, I've always had an interest in this type of history. But, it's just taken a while to find information and, you know, and books and studying. And I've been taking my time about it, but it just, I don't know, I just find that black women's history, especially radical history of women of color, is just the most fascinating thing. It's most inspiring. It's truly heroic compared to any other aspect of American history, in my opinion. And reading about Angela Davis and you know, Kathleen Cleaver, Elaine Brown of the Black Panthers, you know, Zora Neale Hurston, the writer of the Harlem Renaissance. It's really inspiring. So, and it's just, I don't know, it just feels natural to dedicate my art to it.
There's also Lucy Parsons.
Yes, exactly. Lucy. Oh, yes.
Yes.
I mean, it's not enough.
Oh, there's, you could go on and on.
Exactly.
All these names that we should.
Ida B. Wells, you know, and so on.
They should be in our textbooks. They're not.
Well, yeah, there's a lot, and there's not a lot of information in textbooks about this and about the contribution, you know, especially African-American women in the Old West. I mean, how many people know about that, you know?
Not many.
The contributions there.
No, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you a question.
Do
you consider yourself a feminist?
Yes, I have no problem with the word. I think it's a great word.
Yes, I do too. I consider myself one.
I think the fear of the word feminism, you know, and it seems like it's becoming a bad word now. You know, there's a lot of women who get to a certain point who are powerful but won't use the word feminist because they think it has bad connotations, and it does in the mainstream media. But I think feminism, especially radical feminism, is still one of the most just incredible agents of change. It is one of the most revolutionary ideologies, I think, and it shouldn't be forsaken.
Now, how? I had this question that sounded real profound, and I thought, no. What? How is the word interaction going to work on this?
In other words, there will be certain little art thing like assemblages, and I have this big board with a writing on it and a picture from a cover of a book on black feminism. And you're going to be invited to comment. I'm going to give questions. I'm going to pose problems. And I'm going to want you to write on some of the artwork. You'll write directly on it. That'll be part of you'll contribute to the art. And then I have things where you'll be asked questionnaires of certain questions about, like, you know, there'll be tough questions, you know, especially for white people. Like, my one is, it's about what do you prefer, a light-skinned woman, a dark-skinned woman? What do you find aesthetically attractive? And I just want to see how people respond to things like that. And you'll put it in a box.
That's right.
And I might make a book out of that.
Now, again, the information, where and
okay,
when?
Okay, it's at Body Tribe.
Body Tribe.
That same place in Midtown Sacramento from 6 to 10 p.m., March 11th, which is this coming up Saturday, 21st Street, 920 21st Street.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with that.
I really appreciate you giving me the time.
No problem, Tom.
Okay.
Dardon, bye-bye.
Okay, bye, John.
Okay. Now, did I tell you this was going to be a full show or what? I am joined, speaking of feminists and the positive feminine, I'm joined in studio with two poets, Chris Irving and Catherine Smith, and they're going to be doing a presentation. Let's bring down Mr. Peck. And on, again, I'm going to let you folks tell us where, when, and what's this all about. Let me get you.
What a pleasure to come in after this gentleman.
Wasn't he fun?
Yeah, he's got my vote.
You got my mic on now?
I got everybody.
Great.
So are we.
Boy, that was a nice segue for us. I'm glad to follow him anytime.
So, what is the name of your show?
What Do Women Want?
Okay. I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you give us a little hint as what do women want?
It's a teaser. It's actually the subtitle of one of the fairy tales from the Arthurian cycle. It's the subtitle of a tale of King Arthur and Sir Gawain. And they basically, to save King Arthur's life, they have to search the kingdom to answer a magic riddle. What do women want? And we thought that would be a nice teaser to tell that tale, and some of the archetypal symbols in it, and interweave it with our poetry. We thought that would be more fun than just standing up and reading our own poems, which, by their own nature of who we are pretty strong about the feminine.
Well, that sounds... I do have a little business to attend here, too.
Okay.
I have to remind everybody that you listen to KVMR FM Nevada City. That's 89.5 in the foothills and via translator K286AN in Truckee, Tahoe at 105.1 FM and on the World Wide Web at kvmr.org. I understand there's going to be music there, too, in a manner of speaking. Well...
I told John a little bit. We're going to do a little bit of what I'd call poetry slapstick. We're going to announce different sections of the fairy tale dramatically, yes.
And we're going to have a surprise guest jester, a sacred clown, as she prefers to be called.
Now, you poets have brought some poetry and trust
yes,
with you, too,
yes,
to share
we
with
did.
Us?
Yes, we did, and we weren't avoiding your question, but when Chris and I were evolving this, we really enjoy reading each other's work and reading together, and because of the synchronicity of working together and some of the creative fun that happens, some of our poetry is very playful, some of it's very deep, but you can only feed people strong meat so much, so our idea of doing this poetry reading was to present very strong, very deep poems, but in a very playful way while playing with the symbols and provoking people to think a little bit.
And the poems aren't written directly to the story. They're just things that are tangential that we went through our work, some old, some new, and picked out because they seem to resonate.
And now this Arthurian legend, what brought you to doing that from author, which is, you know, quite often considered very male, very the sort of the dark side in some cases of the male?
Well, first of all, this story is very unusual, and I kind of think it just got stuck in there, kind of sidled in under the table the way women so often have to do to get included. And this is a kind of a sneaky story. And so it appealed to us from that point of view.
Well, it appealed to us as women, and it appeals to me as someone who's a Celtic scholar, because my partner Jeremiah really dived into Celtic symbols with me. And what I discovered reading a lot of the Arthurian tales is a lot of them are written like between the 1200s to 1400s. But some of them have the underpinnings of a lot older myths from anywhere from 500 A.D. to 1000 A.D. And we know that Arthur lived around 500 A.D. So the Arthurian tales actually were almost 1,000 years before a lot of these tales of courtly love. So they changed and evolved, and that's sort of the teaser of what we're doing, is we're sort of talking about the nuances of love with a lot of these older conflicts and symbols, and I think they still speak to us in a powerful way, or we wouldn't keep reinventing the King Arthur tales.
Yeah, yes,
that's my take on it.
Arthur, for some reason, really resonates with a lot of people. There's something, I don't know... It certainly with boys and young men, the adventures of the knights and courage and
the hero archetype is deep within each of us, and it appeals to both men and women, both as something incredibly attractive and also as something that one wants to do oneself, a way one wants to envision oneself. So actually in this particular story, we have a very equal balance between the male and the feminine as far as heroic acts go, really. I mean, both characters display courage and integrity and kind of moral in the best sense of the word, straightforwardness.
Yeah, I think morality, as we see it, certainly in modern times, is pretty broad, depending on your point of view. I mean, or very narrow. There are some people of a particular religious bent whose morality is almost entirely centered around sexual activity, whereas I think the Arthurian legend was much, much broader, the idea of morality and courage.
Well, I think the whole, the reason I am interested in those cycle of tales and why I think they apply to a lot of the poems Chris and I have written, to me, as somebody who's mature and reflecting back, at least I think I'm mature part of the time, a lot of them are about love, and a lot of our modern media tales are about heroes and heroines fighting their own dragons, their own demons, or trying to achieve something, but I think when you get into myths of kingship and queenship, and not just trying to achieve them, but trying to maintain them, and what does it mean, whether you're the king of the land or queen of the land, or whether you're just a king in your own personal kingship, it's really complex, and it's a deep struggle that we all struggle with throughout our entire lives. And I think that's why the King Arthur story is still so powerful to us. It's not just about King Arthur the young man or Guinevere the young woman. I think it's how did they maintain their kingdom, what was glorious about it, and what was dark about it.
Absolutely. There's that quality of nobility, which becomes more and more important to one, I think, as we age. It does to me. Certainly, you have that idea in Buddhism, for example, of the noble way of living, of a noble way of being in the world. And there's this sense of obligation, and that part of being a poet, you know, and part of doing this work and getting the word out and actually speaking what I've written, for me, that's part of that kingship, that mastery that one comes to, you know. And then there's the obligation to share it. Not because my point of view is better or wiser or anything, but just because it's unique, because I'm unique, because everybody's unique. And there's a way that I can contribute out of that quality to the world.
And we've been having a lot of fun with this title, because as Chris and I have been discussing this program with people, and reading some of our poems, we're really astonished at the variety of people's reactions to our poems or the title about what do women, in parenthesis, and men, really want, because it shouldn't be that big a mystery. But obviously it is a mystery that we keep reinventing our entire lives.
Well, speaking of poetry, would you like to share a little bit of it with us?
Oh, yes, of course.
I can twist your arm there, I see.
Absolutely. Catherine, you want to go first?
Yeah. Now, this is one I'm not going to read, but I picked it because St. Paddy's Day is coming up, and you might say this is one of my personas, which is sort of the Celtic bard who has something to say, and this is called The Celtic Priestess Nags NASA.
I like that
You
title.
Like that one? And you might say this is some of the flavor of the program we're going to be doing. Well, me hearts, what be you up to? I canna believe it. You sent 3 men to her silvery self with none of your chieftains. No bards, no Olava's magic to sweep the threshold before you or ask the help of the fair folk in other worlds. And worse, my God, much worse, by Morrigan and Maeve, no bleeding woman with an ocean neath her navel to honor the lunar ebb and swell. How could you have done it? Such rotten dishonor to the queen of the sky. 'Tis no wonder you only saw rocks and dust. And I hear one of your sailors has gone mad, like Sweeney, in a good way. Now sees ways to correct earthly wrongs, that we is all one clan, in one leaky curragh. You may be fine astronauts, but I only see herdsmen of flying torches. When you go again on such a quest, by God, take at least one bard to say holy words, to see with eyes gleaming of the she, and tell us the magic to take us all further When we're ready to know, we be more than rocks and dust.
Mm. Mm. Oh, yes. Skip Allen would like that one.
Would he?
Yes, good. He used to work for NASA.
I didn't know that. That's
yes,
great.
Yes, he said he was very good at wasting our tax dollars. But no more.
So, you know, one of the roles of the Celtic bards was to make fun of what was happening, especially at the higher power levels. So I take that role very seriously. I've actually written some poems like that about our board of supervisors and had a lot of fun with them.
Yes, I wrote a poem about a board mm-hmm. member. And mm-hmm. Actually, it wasn't a board member. It was someone who was trying to get a board member recalled, and nobody wanted to print it.
Oops. Well, I know Chris is just itching here, Rika, and she's got great poems.
Oh,
so.
Of course mm-hmm. she does. I've read her poetry, so I have her book. Okay, Chris, you're at the plate.
Okay, so I'm reading a poem called "The Bear from the North Came Over the Mountain." There's actually two versions of this poem, and the other version I will read at the reading.
This is the radio version?
They're very different,
they're
but they're
palatable.
The same. So it was interesting to do this because they have two different voices. But anyway, so this is based on an old Indian tale. The bear from the north came over the mountain. She saw the man before he saw her, watched smooth brown skin slide across bunched muscle, shiny black hair, eagle feathers, bead-encrusted buckskin. Bear wanted that warrior to love her. She shed her shaggy skin, widened her piggy eyes, retracted the long claws, painted her cheekbones red with blackberries. He saw a woman gleaming in the sun, naked among the bee-strung berry bushes, and fell in love. Or so he thought. She demanded too much and not enough. Exact accounting of his days, but never his dreams. Their loving turned angry, dry, but on and on she lusted, and oh, how she talked. He missed his sisters, his father, his brothers, his tribe. He wanted to go home. Summer subsided. She grew distracted, weary, and fat, too bored to resist their return to the village. The man's mother looked up. She knew this new daughter. Kill her while she sleeps, whispered his mother. The man slew his bear wife. The tribe feasted on her flesh. Little sister tamed the pelt. Big brother hung the ears above his bed and stripped the head bone bare. The man who had married a bear turned shaman, crazed by his calling, forever hearing visions, foraging four-legged in the spirit world. They made his mother chief. Little sister sat beside her. The grandmothers counseled her. The grandfathers nagged her. Women gathered roots and berries. Men hunted. The tribe prospered.
Wow. Yes.
A fierce poem.
Aye, a good one.
An encounter with the hag.
Well, I think we...
And actually, that's one of our subdivisions of the story, the encounter with the hag.
Well, how many divisions are there in the story?
Well, it's artificial. We made seven, but we kind of did a Joseph Campbell number. So we're going to call this kind of a Josepha Campbell afternoon, and basically we're just going to talk about the story and intersperse our poems with it, and a little bit about the symbols in it.
Well, you know, poetry is obviously made or constructed of symbols that resonate or should resonate at a soul level rather than at the brain level, so.
You got it.
I write poetry too, so. But I ask this of everyone who writes that I have an opportunity to corner. What is your creative process like? Do you Do you wait for the muse to whisper in your ear, or do you sit down and write regularly on a schedule, as it were?
Well, it depends. There are times when I get my act together and I write every day, and there are other times when I'm pounced by the muse and I can't help it. I just have to sit down. And then there are times when I have an idea or a feeling about something I want to write, and it's like being pregnant. There's just this gestation period where it won't come and it won't do anything, and it's just sitting there, but I can feel it changing and growing. And then usually one day, often when I'm walking, a line will come to me, and then that poem will come. It's a very different process for each poem.
And you, Catherine?
I've written all my life, and I think they were pretty much writing for myself. And when I started performing my poetry, and especially writing poems for occasions, it was my women friends who helped me realize my gift, I would say. So, I think when you have a gift or a talent, it becomes both a gift and an affliction. If you don't use it well, and if you don't share it, then what's the point? For me, it's I say that poetry can be fun, or music, or doorways to another world. So for me, we've got a little funny noise here, speaking of muses from other worlds, so John's going to figure that out.
I don't know what that is.
So for me, poetry can be entertainment, but I like it better when there's some teaching or some inspiration, that there's that sharing process, just like when you're performing music at a concert, which is why Chris and I are doing this. We have this really full bouquet of poems, and we wanted to share them in a fun way.
That's a very interesting analogy, bouquet.
Mm-hmm.
How many poems are there that are going to be presented?
I'd say about 20.
About 20.
And if we have time, it may be more, but one of the teasers we're going to do is we're going to ask the audience to also see what they think women really want to.
Okay, now, we're this far into it, and I want to remind everybody that this is Booktown. I'm John Fletcher, and I'm talking with Catherine Smith and Chris Irving, and they're doing a poetry reading, and it's more than that, but it will be at
Jason's Coffee Shop next to Booktown, and it's free.
And when?
March 12th, which is Sunday.
Time?
This Sunday from 2 to 4.
Okay. And the public is welcome. I also have to remind people that because of ABC restrictions, and since Jason does carry wine, it's restricted to anyone. They have to be 21 years or older to attend. So,
But if you're younger, you can hang out in the book area and hear it. Our material's not restricted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's that wonderful area just to the... right at the doorway between the two places, where that's a fairly open area where you can hang out and listen. So it's another poem?
Why don't you go ahead, Chris?
Okay. This is called the Domovoya, which is a Russian word for concierge. Crick, crack, crinkle. Babushkas cut their twigs, lashing willow to birch, string stretched taut by wide flat finger pads and thickened thumbs. Swish, swash, swish, swash. Babushkas stride backward, bending forward, sweeping their tracks from roadways as they go. On the edge of town they mount their brooms, rubbing themselves with oil. Poppy, castor, clove, rosemary, opening to Baba Yaga, who stirs her pot and sends them shooting like wild comets over tundra, taiga, and steppe. Clip-clop, clip-clop, a horseman is coming, clad in gold armor, riding a golden horse. Babushkas fall from the sky like bats, drifting down to doze in doorways, lizard eyes cloaking bright blackberry. eyes. You wish to enter? Hush, hush, hush. Silent, shadow-wise, tiptoe toward the threshold. Avoid, if you can, bony hands flung out to catch. Can you sidestep their reckoning and pass?
If you've ever been to Russia and seen that, that goes on today. The sweeping of the streets by the babushkas. And have you something for us, Catherine?
Okay. I didn't think we'd have that much time. So
we'll cut it a little close, but that's okay.
Cut it close? I'll read this one, and this is one that I am going to read. And I've been working on a book of prayers, and this is one of them that I wrote a few years ago for a May Day celebration. And at the beginning of our story, the heroes enter a magic forest. So this is, for all you fellows, this is an invocation to the horned god. We have looked in the forest. We have looked in the valleys. His voice rustles in green reeds. His hooves stamp the dry grass, now wet with new growth. He will drink with her by the river. Come, husband of flock and field. Come, gentle guardian. Come, horned one, Cernunnos, Demuzi, Dionysus. You, spruce-crowned morning star who descends to white feather woman. Come, eyes of stars, speech of dark cloud, limbs of strong trees. Come, heat of rising blood, strength of purpose. Come, agility and grace of embodied spirit. You, seeker of the hidden lady, come into flesh, horned one.
Ooh, well, that...
I thought your Irish blood would like that, John.
Yes, and that's it. That's a tribute to the male.
It is. That's the whole point. There is not going to be men bashing at this. I should say that. Men are always afraid women are going to do that, you know?
Well, they have been to a Robert Bly workshop. So I have. But, okay. Let's wrap this up. And, again, with the information is to, it's again Sunday the 12th.
Correct. Yes.
At Jason's Cafe.
Correct.
In Grass Studio
Valley.
Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is located in Booktown Books.
And that's at 134 Bank Street. No, pardon me, 134 South Auburn Street. And will you have books for sale of your poetry?
Yes. Yes, we will. But that's not required. Just enjoy yourselves, and we'll have really juicy conversation afterwards, I'm sure, and lots of goodies.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, John.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Well, I would like to remind everybody that you've been listening to Booktown. We just had a wonderful interview with poetry from Catherine Smith and Chris Irving. And it's a wonderful event coming up on Sunday. So hope to see you there. I'm John Fletcher, and I want to remind you of the fact that this last hour has been underwritten by the Wooden Spoon Kitchenware Store, a toy store for cooks. The Wooden Spoon has served Nevada County for over 20 years. Their newly expanded store is in the Fowler Center at 12066 Nevada City Highway in Grass Valley, 530-272-8980. I would like to thank Eric Tome for letting me sit in, having the trust that I could do this for him. And let's go out with a group called the Sycamore Park Committee to Preserve Funky Jazz and Jazzy Funk. And stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party coming right up.